Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, this is John Mullen at the Guardian Book Club, and I'm talking to Jeanette Winterson about Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. Jeanette's very gamely agreed to do something that we quite like to do in the Guardian Book Club, which is to kind of take writers right back to their early classics. I'm sure most of you here, you don't need a sort of guided tour through Jeanette's oeuvre, but perhaps I could just tell you what I always do when I'm looking for a kind of word of wisdom on literary matters, what two of my students said about your oeuvre yesterday, actually, because I was trying to do this rather pathetic thing of sort of basking vicariously in your glory and saying, oh yes, well I'm interviewing Jeanette Winterson tomorrow. And the first two very quite sort of modish undergraduates, and the first of them said, oh God, I've read lots of her books. And then the second one, who's possibly the cooler of the two actually, said, and she's not just a writer, is she? I mean, she runs a shop.
Oh yeah.
And the first one said, really? And the second one said, yeah, in Spitalfields. And the first one went, so, I mean, for UCL students, that's a kind of highest approbation. So
that's because I come from the north and we've all got two jobs.
And I you'll probably find, Jeanette, in the course of my questions, that my undergraduates have sort of, I don't know if to fear or to hope this, have influenced my questions about your novel quite a lot, because I claim no special sort of academic expertise in late 20th century fiction, but I've marked a lot of essays. And I've kind of stored up, I think, the sharp things to say and the errors, you know, and I hope that kind of, I hope I know the difference between
my errors.
No. No. The misreadings, you see. I hope I'm purged by the students of the misreadings, but you must tell me. I was going to start with the Bible. Is that all right? I was going to start by asking about the Bible.
Best place.
Because actually, rereading it, I was thinking that I was taught medieval literature by quite a sort of, frightening lady at university, frightening Scottish lady, and who said to me, who terrified me by saying to me right at the beginning in our first meeting, she said, you have a great advantage, Mr. Mullen, in approaching this literature, none of which I knew anything about. And she said, for if my file is correct, you have been brought up as a Roman Catholic. None of the iconography will be new to you. And I never quite sort of found it, the advantage that she'd sort of predicted. But I did think rereading the novel, that sort of it showed what I do sometimes tell the new students, the literary advantages of a religious upbringing. And I just wanted to ask you about the use of the Bible, the structuring of the novel by the books of the Bible, the books of the Old Testament, and it's sort of it's being full of quotes and allusions, and I mean, quite often that's sort of described, I've seen it described as a kind of parody of kind of biblical knowledge. And I reading the novel, I thought, isn't it, you know, it shows kind of what an incredible advantage it is to have the Bible in your head when you sit down to write.
I think it is an advantage in many ways, but I wanted to write my own version of the Bible because I'd got rather tangled up in the other one. And I thought it would be better to start again. And it seemed to me to use those books as it goes through Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. I couldn't go any further because we couldn't get into 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings and 2 Kings, could we? And so on. So it was better, I thought, to stop at Ruth, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, on you go. There's only 66 of them, fortunately, but it's, you have to learn them, and then, of course, you can't forget them. I thought it was a good way to begin to unravel something which had become overcomplicated for me. And I'd realised with my own strange background that quite early on that it's much better to read yourself as a fiction than it is to read yourself as a fact, because the facts are always oppressive, and I came back to this much later in the Power Book in 2000. They never really tell the truth. You always feel squashed somewhere. When you look at yourself as a fact, when you read yourself as a fiction, then you realise that you can change the story because you are the story, so that there's always a new beginning, always a different end, a possibility of narrative rewrite, which can be applied to everything that you do. And this was my way into it. And it seemed to me that to take a sacred text and to make it into a personal text was a way of beginning to do that. So it's not a parody, it's a rewrite.
And when Jeanette in the novel kind of leaves home, I mean, she goes off with her Bible, doesn't she? She takes
Yes, she wouldn't leave that behind, because it would be necessary on the journey. I mean, she doesn't have much to take, so that has to go too. And I wanted to find a way of making that character and myself into another creature, a third creature. It doesn't work as autobiography in the strict sense, and it never did, but it was at the beginning in 1985 of something which then became very popular, which was the kind of fictionalised memoir which then became a whole thing in its own right. What I was trying to do at the time, as well as play with the Bible, was think about two books that have meant a great deal to me. One was Gertrude Stein's The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, you know, which is a delicious book, as you know, because right at the end of it, when Alice has written it, she says, you know, I'm a pretty good cook and a pretty good seamstress and a pretty good secretary. And I didn't have time to write it. So then Gertrude Stein said, well, as you haven't had time to write your autobiography, I'll write it for you. It's the most marvellously audacious end paragraph. And it just trashes the whole thing and turns it on its head. You think you've been reading one narrative and you're reading another. And then, of course, 1928, same year, was Virginia Woolf's Orlando. It's the anniversary next year. It's quite interesting, 1928. It's also the Well of Loneliness. but we won't go there. So we've got two. And I thought, you know, Orlando, look how that starts. The first line is he, for there could be no doubt of his sex. And then we spend the whole rest of the novel doubting his sex. And I love that cheek and that audacity. And it was those two models that I wanted to use to see, well, how can you push this forward a bit more? Can you make yourself into a character in your own fiction? Of course, when girls do it, it's called autobiography. When boys do it, like Milan Kundera, it's called metafiction. Paul Auster, Martin Amis, all metafiction. But with girls, it's autobiography, because you only can write about yourself.
But you do give the character your name, your own Christian name.
Yes.
So you tempt the reader to kind of at least think about it, don't you, and to wonder about which of the things in the novel are likely to be kind of based on something in
particular. Yeah, a checklist, a sort of tick box, did she do this or didn't she do that, wouldn't really work. And it is a tease, it's true. But, you know, from that moment anyway, I've wanted to develop, because I always use the first person, and I wanted a narrative which was entirely intimate, lover's talk, really, a secret diary, but at the same time confessing its own artifice. So that there's all, you know, it's like being in the theatre. You know it's pretend. You know, theatre's not crap film, it's pretend. And you go and you join in the pretense as part of the emotional journey. And I think that's what fiction is very good at doing, of saying, you know, not the realistic structure, but saying, yes, of course I'm making this up, but we're in it together, and it will take us to a deeper truth than telling the ordinary truth of the facts ever could do.
Yeah, but there's little sort of, I suppose I found myself noticing, I hadn't, when I first read it, that there are little, they're just sort of little touches. I'm not thinking actually of the sort of the most important things that happen to the character. They're little touches which make you kind of think that something must have been taken from experience, something like the way you sort of sometimes switch from the past to the present tense. So
Yeah, that always annoys the proofreaders. And it still does. When we were proofreading The Stone Gods, she kept saying, did you mean to do this? I thought, yes, bye now.
I was thinking there was a bit I just noticed for the first time recently, when it's about the protagonist, the narrator's mother wants her to move out. And it says, my mother wanted me to move out, and she had the backing of the pastor and most of the congregation, or so she said. I made her ill, made the house ill, brought evil into the church. There was no escaping this time. I was in trouble. Picking up my Bible, the hill seemed the only place to go just then. On the top of the hill is a stone mound to hide behind when the wind blows. And it's at kind of the moments like that. It's kind of inescapably, you know, verifiable by particular details, which one must be able to go and find.
Yes, it's very much the place. No, it is the place, the long stretchy street with the town at the bottom and the hill at the top. It never had much going for it, as even less now. But it is that place.
The mother never calls the daughter by her name in the novel, is that right?
I don't know. It's ages since I wrote it.
I think she doesn't. I thought that was all brilliantly.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I meant to do. I can't remember.
I think I went through looking for the name, and it's always one of the members of the church or one of the teachers who says Jeanette. So Jeanette acquires a sort of faintly admonitory kind of ring to it, because and the mother, the character's mother, never uses her name, I think.
How interesting.
Yeah. You weren't aware. And the name was changed in the TV.
Yeah, I did that.
Yeah. I mean, why is that?
Because television is such a crass medium to begin with. It can be multiple, but it is heavy-handed and it is literal. And I thought, I really do not want this going on screen and being read in this over-literal way, which the book can continually undercut. You can do that in there. You can't do it when you shove it on the screen. And I thought, we're not having this. So let's stop it before it starts. So that seemed to me to be like just a very simple way of making life easier for me.
I suppose that when I first read it, the episode where I most wondered, I'll get off the autobiography in a second, but just the one which made me wonder, is this autobiographical or is this entirely imagined, was the discovery of the adoption papers, which is sort of mentioned a couple of times, and almost in passing, parenthetically. I just wondered, I mean, was that... That wasn't an autobiographical thing that was in the fiction when it was placed there.
Well, there are so many bits of paper when you're adopted. I mean, because I recently found some more which told me, which added mystery to the story, further mystery to an already strange story. That was the what I found then was the birth certificate, because it changes, of course, and you don't get the original one; you get the later one. But I did find the original one, and I recently found some other bits of paper which told me that I had another name and everything. The thing was not simple, and it wasn't straight away, and I will not be able to get to the bottom of it because somebody went to great pains to make sure I never would. So I found a piece of paper saying that I was fit and healthy enough to be adopted. This was 6 weeks after I was born, which is late, and that I had been breastfed. You don't. If they're going to give you away straight away. This is the mystery, as I found recently in May. The Adoption Society name had been torn off from the top of this piece of paper very violently, and it said name of infant, and it had been crossed out in heavy biro. And then the name of the doctor who'd signed it at the bottom had also been torn off very violently. So someone, I suppose Mrs. Winston, had gone to great lengths. I didn't know that piece of paper existed, nor its counterpart, which was the final thing from the county court, which was in 1960, so that's late. So whatever happened in between is another story, which I cannot tell, but I was another person, wasn't I, for a while, with two other names underneath the blue biro.
Incredible.
I know. I might take it to... I suppose you could see through it if you took it to the right person, couldn't you?
Well, there's somebody who's edited Fanny Burney's letters, who's had to do that with...
Oh, really?
Because because Fanny Burney went through journals and yes, and they that at figures, the University of Toronto, they developed a fantastic machine just to do which now everybody who's got letters with crossings out sends their stuff to, and they can see through.
Well,
everything.
I'm going to Toronto next year. I'll take it with me. Then some more will be revealed. But I think one of the pieces that I have written, which is coming out on Saturday, I think, was really about as you read back into what you were doing. You only understand your own motives later, and of course there are many motives. And one is that you want to create something, but also in my case, that there is an imperative to invent and to create yourself, as you don't really exist unless you do that, which I think was an imperative for me. And the reason that this story is still around 22 years later, I suppose, though, is not that it's a strange story and it's an interesting story, but that wouldn't be enough to carry it. It's how you make the crossover so that it becomes other people's story, even though it's completely remote from their own experience and their own lives, so that there's an emotional charge which goes on hitting people of very different backgrounds across time, and that's what makes it work or not. And I suppose that's what you don't know, because any time can tell.
Yeah, I think one of the things it does, the strange materials, but which is kind of, I don't know, universal, everybody recognises, that extraordinary thing of the girl in the book being brought up in a way that most of the readers would think pretty strange, but herself, of course, not being in a position to know it's strange.
No, you never know.
And taking to it entirely naturally. Mm. And I think we all have that, I suppose, I mean, without, you know, it's a cliche perhaps to say, we all have that experience of, as it were, the first time in your life, sometimes perhaps it's very late in life, where you suddenly recognise that your upbringing must look rather peculiar to somebody else.
Yes. And we all think it's normal. Whatever our parents do, we think is normal. I thought everybody had a gospel tent. But no.
Well, I thought I'd bring that sort of bit of when the character's mother is summoned and told that Jeanette has been terrifying the children at primary school with stories of hellfire, and the narrator says, "Well, you know, I'm just giving them a chance." I mean, you know.
Yeah, we were particularly strong on that. I mean, it was. An evangelical community, and you have to preach the word, you have to save souls, and I believed all of that. It wasn't a pretense, and it certainly wasn't an intellectual exercise. It was who I was at that time, and it was only by shattering all of that anything else was made possible, in the shattering of it. And then, of course, you have to. The only way you come out of that is by remaking it somehow, and remaking the text that made you, which takes us back to those books of the Bible.
I mean, the narrator comes out of it, but actually, I meant to ask this at the end, but I'll ask it now. The novel ends with her going back.
Yeah,
it
does.
And there's the mother with her electronic organ.
Yes.
And indeed, it has one of my favourite last sentences in world fiction, actually.
That's good.
This is kindly like calling Manchester, come in Manchester, this is kindly like.
She did have
on
a CB radio.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, she loved gadgets, Mrs. Winterson. Should have missed her time, really. And because she didn't want to be in the same bed as my dad ever, and because the house was very small, that meant she had to stay up all night, you know. So there was always somebody awake. It was quite good when you came downstairs, but she was endlessly baking. She was baking cakes and listening on her radio to Ivan Popoff broadcasting behind the Iron Curtain. Illegally and illicitly during the night. So you'd always come down there with this great machine broadcasting away the truth of Jesus before... against communism, and there'd be my mother baking in the kitchen and the fire lit. That is an abiding memory of my childhood.
And for the readers, I suppose, the mother in the novel is simply a kind of brilliantly unforgettable character. I think if you ask a lot of people, what will you remember about the book, they'll remember, I mean, remember her, and she's kind of...
I wanted
she's
to give her that.
She's quite witty, actually, in a kind of weird way.
Oh,
she's
she was.
Sort of,
she was full,
really
full of phrases, you know, always. I mean, Mrs. Winterson, you know, I mean, you know, the Bible tells us to turn the other cheek, but there's only so many cheeks in a day.
And, you know, she doesn't say that in the novel, though, does she?
No, but she doesn't. She was marvellous like that.
This Mackle outlast your father, that's one
yes.
of my favourite
Oh, ones. Yes, well, yes. Strangely enough, my father is still alive. Uh-huh. He outlasted everything. Mrs. Winterson, Max, the lot. And... you know, when I was leaving home, when it was the choice, after I had fallen in love with another girl, as you do, and made the mistake of saying so. So then the choice was, you know, you stay or you go. And of course you have to go, don't you? Because if you stay, you just get, then neurosis sets in. You can't sacrifice what's important for what's comfortable. You simply have to make that choice straight away. I mean, you know, everybody suffers in life, and either you suffer directly for the thing that is the thing you're struggling with, or you become neurotic because you're suffering indirectly for the thing that you're avoiding struggling with. And either way, you will suffer, so you might as well do it clean. I learned this early on, and so I thought, well, it's going to be awful, but you know, it's going to be awful. So let's at least take something that makes me feel dignified. So off I went, and as I was leaving, she called me back and she said, "Jeanette," and I thought, oh, maybe she's going to change her mind. And she said, "Why be happy when you could be normal?" But you know. It was a great question, and I took it with me. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that. It was as wise a riddle as any that had ever asked in fairy tales. And if you get the right answer, you might get the treasure or the princess. And if you get the wrong answer, then it's going to be death by ogre or some similar awful catastrophe. But I remember, because when I left home at first, I had to sleep in the back of a car, and it was a Hillman Imp, which are small. So it's fortunate that I was too. And I was lying in there thinking about happy normal and whether it was a straightforward dichotomy like hot and cold day and night, and I thought I knew that it wasn't. So straight away I had an existentialist problem to deal with, which strangely cheered me up. Because I felt at least that something was happening instead of it just being a misery, compounded misery. And off I went.
She's quite sort of, she is a kind of a brilliant character on the page. I mean, can you, perhaps it's too long ago to remember, I mean, well, there must have been a certain kind of writerly pleasure in writing her as a character, or was it
yes.
too, yeah, was there a pleasure in doing it? Because even when she's, even the sort of balmiest things she says, actually, are kind of have a certain, I don't know, there was a thing, what was she saying about snails, I noticed when I...
Oh yeah, balmy.
Yeah,
balmy.
But brilliant, it's yeah. brilliant. What she said, the family life of snails, somebody comes on the BBC talking about the next programme's the family life of snails, and she says, the family life of snails, it's an abomination, it's like saying we come from monkeys. and of course, I mean, you know, you think balmy, but there is a certain perceptiveness about
yes.
it. Well, yeah, the family life of snails. Yeah, that is stupid.
Yes, she certainly did. I mean, she was very colourful. I mean, she was large in life. She was 20 stone and tall as well. I mean,
oh, really?
Yeah.
She was 20, God.
And 5'10". Oh. And I'm not... So there was a size challenge.
Ah, yes.
Straight away. So, you know, I've always been a bit sort of buzzing at her, really, like sort of sprite thing, stinging away
yes.
against
yeah.
this monument. And always, you know, the full handicap pinny and
yes.
slippers and, you know, hair curlers, the lot. So quite not a creature that you had to stand up against, but I think also very unhappy. And I wanted her to have, for once, something that she would have liked. And I think if she could have got through it and got there, she'd have been pleased about this. But she did manage to die in the second episode of Oranges, when it's the sex scene. I mean, yeah.
She didn't.
She did. I can say this. I mean, 17 years have passed since it was on the telly, so I can speak freely now. She did.
And she was watching it?
Yes. I mean, you have to be quite robust, you know, to come out, survive Mrs. Winterson one way and another. No, she can't get you the first time. She goes in for another,
yeah.
another shot. She did, yes. Quite extraordinary.
And did she read the book?
She did read the book. She was livid. Because in those days, there weren't any mobile phones anyway. So, and there weren't, she didn't have a telephone. And you know, I'd written to her. We hadn't seen each other for a long time. I said, I've done this. And we made a rendezvous that I would telephone her from one phone box and she would trudge around the corner and pick it up in the other phone box in Accrington. Which is what happened. So I went to my phone box in London and she went to her phone box. And we spoke and I said, you know, look, it's not about us in any real way. It's about, and I started to explain. She said, it's the first time I've had to order a book in a false name. And she was so cross. And never really, I mean, after that, it did not work in any real way because she, you know, she'd always been angry and suspicious of the written word. And she didn't want me to come in contact with it or to read anything that wasn't religious literature. To actually to have written something and had it published, and for it to be clearly the work of the devil, you know, awful for her. And yet, in some ways, she could have. It might have worked out, you know, if we'd had a bit longer. But I couldn't mend it by when she died because I was 30 and it was too early, 29 actually. And she, we didn't have time. So sometimes you cannot get there, and you have to accept that.
It's a novel where sort of most of the voices you hear, I mean, there's the character, the narrator's mother, but most of the voices you hear, I suppose, are women's voices. I think apart yeah. from Joe the Undertaker comes in later. And the father in the novel is about whom the narrator says quite nice things, you know, and affectionate things. And he doesn't speak in the whole...
No, he doesn't. I mean, he still doesn't speak. in fact, he married again, my father, which was lovely, because he married somebody who was completely non-religious. And, in fact, sort of brokered a rapprochement between he and I. And every time, you know, he'd go into the kitchen to get something, she'd say, it was all your mother's fault, wasn't it? Everything was all your mother's fault. Desperately trying to sort it out. And he had 15 years of a completely different life and actually was happy, I think, for the first time. But he still didn't speak.
Not at all.
No, and he still does not speak. I mean, if it's impossible. You know, when I see him now, it just does not speak. I took him to Blackpool this week, and we went through. I thought, well, he won't go again because he's 90. So we went through the lights, you know, one of those awesome cart things, and I thought it was great, but he didn't speak at all. It's quite a feat going to Blackpool and going to the Pleasure Beach, fish and chips at Harry Ransdom's, and the Illuminations in Orlando, and not speaking. But I've got used to it.
So that was kind of documentary realism. So I think I wrote something in the newspaper column saying it was a brilliant fictional technique, you know, that kind of, because Jane Austen does it a bit sometimes. She has these characters who constantly they're there, but they actually never speak directly. Captain Bennett in Persuasion, he's always having conversations, but he never speaks. No, you never get any word. So I was saying, it's not a sort of just a sort of kind of metafictional strategy.
No, this is
it's just the way it was.
This was the way it was, and it was a useful incorporation.
Yeah, and the voices that you do get, remind me quite a bit of my friend Amanda, who comes from Preston. There's a kind of there's a sort of coming together of the sort of, in the case of the mother, it's always to do with religion, but the religious and the eternal and the terrifying with the absolutely incredibly sort of ordinary. So it's always, I don't know, the Society for the Lost in Wigan. You know, that seems to me somehow to epitomise that sort of weird collision of the sort of eschatological and the banal that you get in her, but also kind of her fellow members of the church as well. You know, sort of they're always said of saying, there's a bit where the mother sits Jeanette down to tell her how she almost was lost with the... Is it Pierre?
Yeah.
And she says, I'm going to tell you I almost went to the bad. Have a Royal Scot biscuit, you know.
Yes. I think those things do sit side by side, and especially in the North, where there still is, I think, quite a flamboyant and feisty defiant attitude towards life, because it has often been very hard and still is hard, and so you make a joke of it, but more than that, you give it a kind of operatic quality, because that's what helps you get through. So you make your circumstances larger than life, A, so that you can look at them, and B, so that they become bearable. Because if everything is sort of small and mean, then what's life worth? I mean, I think it's often the way that we survive is by pumping up the narrative so that we can tell it back to ourselves and others, and then it is a relief.
Mm. But it's also that's sort of the Bible thing as well, isn't it? That the mother kind of has sort of apposite quotations from the New Testament for a visit down to that lady who sells things to kill vermin.
Mrs. Artwright. Artwright's for vermin, yeah. Yes, it's true. There always has to be that. I think language is important, and I still, Alan Bennett's used this a lot, because you still hear marvellous things on buses and trams and in the north that perhaps you don't hear, because the banality of endless sort of TV speak and media dialogue hasn't entirely infiltrated that dialect language, which has, I think, does have a peculiarity of its own, and I still hear it and marvellous things up there, which I love. Though that may go as the older people go. You know, I was on the bus the other day, and somebody said, "Oh yes, she had to go to Fleetwood for her holidays." Think of that, Fleetwood. And there was a pause, and this woman turned, and she said, "Well," she said, "I know somebody who spent all their married life in Fleetwood." I just sit here on the bus, and I love being able to hear things like that and then run away with them.
So you still got that kind of those cadences in your head, have you? You don't?
Oh, very much so.
Because they must. Yeah. They. You can tell when you read. Yes. Orange is not the only fruit that you actually remember.
There's a rhythm to it. Yes, yes. And you know, my mother always called children limbs of Satan. and it's quite a good description, really. So when you see them running around the night, you just see limbs of Satan, everyone.
And the breeding ground.
Oh, the breeding ground, yeah.
So that was...
School was a breeding ground,
So Mrs. Winterson did call it
Yeah, and you say, what's a breeding ground? She says, it's like the sink would be if I didn't put bleach down. So it's simple, vivid metaphors, as you say, drawn from everyday life.
And that, aside from her bon mot, there's also in the book something which actually this time round I thought... was quite sort of easy. I remember when I read it in the 1980s, I thought it was kind of really strange kind of narrative device, and perhaps it was in those days, which is the bits of, and now it seems not strange at all, which is the kind of bits of a fairy tale and sort of, or sometimes kind of spoof fairy tale.
Yeah, no, it's a commonplace now, but it wasn't then.
No.
It's true.
And was that kind of, was that part of the design right the way... from the beginning,
it was because those were the other narratives,
yes.
And I still use them. And I think fairy tales, folk tales, are fantastic ways of trying to understand how the human psyche works, and they're always interesting. And you know, I still, when you know, if things are really bad, I do think to myself, but you know, I think of a sort of combination of Pilgrim's Progress and the usual, I'm lost in the forest. You know, Dante uses it in this dark wood. And it's sometimes better, because you think, blimey, I'm in the middle of a dark wood and there's the fancy lights from the castle, and you know, there's somebody who's going to try and enchant me, but there will be a way through it. And you can read it like that, and I find it quite comforting. And I wanted to put those texts in there to juxtapose against the main narrative and against the overarching biblical narrative. It's just another layer, really. You know, I like layers.
Yeah. I suppose it's sort of, I mean, when I've read, I suppose, interviews with you, and you've explained things which actually in the novel remain unexplained. So, for instance, I hope I don't misremember, but I think I read you saying that one of the few books
mm.
that Mrs. Winterson allowed was Malory's Mort Darthur.
Yeah.
But in the novel, which seems a surprising choice, but anyway, but in the novel, the sort of Arthurian...
Mm.
Passages of narrative come from some completely unexplained place, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I didn't want to explain them. I thought I would just leave them there and let the reader find their own way through and not be too controlling about it. But, you know, When you read it backwards, when you think about it now, then you can explain things that make sense in a particular way. At that time, especially when it's your first book and you're writing it, in quite an unconscious way for me, you bring to bear everything that you've got and then you hope that it will work. And I have never, and I do not, and I never will write sequentially. And Oranges was the same. You know, I didn't start like most people. I lived for a long time with my mother and father. I started with one of the stories and then built it round from there. And I always do that because, to me, it makes more sense because I don't think that things go in straight lines, and I think the mind is more like a maze than a motorway. And when I'm trying to work creatively, I have to let my mind do what it does best and not worry all the time about how things are supposed to be. I mean, God knows, you know, I grew up in a world where nothing was how it was supposed to be, so there's no point trying now. and especially not in fiction, which is a place of freedom. So I think, you know, often people say to me, well, you know, give me some ideas about writing, and I would say, try not to start at the beginning, and don't be afraid that the thing doesn't make sense for a long time. It will, by the end.
I love the presence in the novel and the ingenuity as a reader of it. The presence of Jane Eyre.
And, oh, wasn't that a terrible, wicked thing to have happened?
Well, it's funny, you see, because I use that, Jeanette, because I always think that actually, although it's a bit...
Do you think she should have married St. John Rivers?
Well...
Because that's what happens, you see. Mrs. Winston's reading away, yes. And she just carries on making it up and has Jane marry St. John Rivers.
Yeah, well, I read out the last line of your novel, and I always think,
I had no idea for years until I read it myself. And then that taught me that you just make it up as you go along.
Well, we did this Guardian quiz where we had, amongst other things, last lines of famous novels, and people guessed all of them. Some people guessed all of them, but the only one nobody guessed was a novel that everybody in the room at the time said afterwards they'd read, which was Jane Eyre, which ends, Amen, even so, come Lord Jesus, you see.
That's not great, is it?
That's the last line.
No.
But that's what Charlotte Bronte thought you were going to go away with. And although perhaps the mother takes it a little bit too far, but yeah. I always think that sort of, you know, it's a kind of misreading that Charlotte Bronte might have thought was kind of at least understandable, because you're supposed to feel that St. John Rivers is a bit of a temptation, isn't it? You might want to go off and die with him spreading the gospel.
No. I'm really offended. I mean, not by that, but sometimes I wake up, you know, and I think of it. It's never gone. Even after all these years, the charge of it, of being read to and lied to in the same way.
And do you remember the moment when you find out that it was...
Yes, because I started to find books for myself in the library, which was brilliant because it had all the books you wanted. And then, of course, I discovered it. I never trusted her again.
Well, perhaps it's time for me to hand it over to you. Anybody got a question for Jeanette? Yes, sir.
I'd just like to ask, to what extent, if at all, the process of writing Oranges was serving, amongst other purposes, an entirely understandable purpose for you, of either making sense of a childhood or of distancing and putting a childhood behind oneself. Was there, if you like, a therapeutic or some similar function that was served by writing this as a first book?
I think that there is always, for the person who writes or paints or any of those things, acts, dances, there is a therapeutic function in that it releases possibilities in you that would otherwise lie dormant. And it has a cathartic experience, I suppose. But that isn't its purpose. And if it was an entire... This is what we were talking about earlier. If it was an entirely private matter, then that's where it would have to remain. What's interesting is what alchemy takes place to take that entirely private matter and make it into something that then goes out across a bridge, self-built, into the world, so that it becomes a text which has value to other people. Because what has value to ourselves doesn't necessarily have value to others, not directly. I think one of the real mysteries about art always is that it crosses that bridge, the self-made bridge. It makes it and then it crosses it and it goes on working. And it goes on working long after any contemporary interest or relevance in it is finished. I mean, that's why presumably, you know, there is still art, otherwise we wouldn't look at anything written 400 years ago or 200 years ago or even 100 years ago, because it's not relevant in the obvious sense to our lives, which is why sort of docudrama and the idea of realism and write what you know is so completely rubbish and crap, because if it's going to last, you know, it'll be different people in different times and different places, you know, it won't be us. And they'll be feeling and thinking very differently to us. And the thing that carries it through is something which is stranger and more permanent about the human condition. So yes, it does have a private and a personal function, but that is not its purpose, and that is not where it will get its strength from. There'll be a charge there. I mean, I believe that you always, I know I do anyway, you write from the wound. There is a place in you which is wounded, and it won't heal. I mean, it's a very ancient myth. It's the myth of the Grail. It's the myth of it's the Christ myth. But I think it's a very good myth, because there is always the wound, and there's no point fighting it. The only thing you can do is work from it, so that it becomes a place of creativity and possibility instead of a place of anguish. And that serves not only in a book like Oranges, but then continuing in the last 22 years, you know, everything I've done. Of course it works from the wound, it works from that place, but I can't leave it there. I have to continue. So that makes sense.
I just wondered, at what point in your writing process did the title come about? Oranges are not the only fruit.
Oh, it's a stupid title, isn't it? Isn't it amazing, actually? I mean, this is one of those things. It's a really stupid title, and yet it's found its way into the English language, and, you know, headlines are made out of it.
Yeah, yeah. There was a review of a biography of Nell Gwynn last year, and the headline in the newspaper was, "Oranges are the only fruit."
Yeah, they love that, don't they? Yeah. And it, you know, it switches about, and so it goes. And you know, when I first took it to my publishers, who were at Pandora at the time, and I said, "This is what it's called," they were very sorrowful.
Yeah.
And they just said, "This is, you know, can you not think of another title?" And I said, "No, because this is the title." And off we went. It is ridiculous. Yes, but it does come from... Mrs. Winston was obsessed with oranges because she thought we were all going to die of scurvy, which probably we were in the north. And that in the war, because my parents are old, you see, because, anyway, they adopted me late, blah, blah. So they'd all been in the war. And I don't know if you've ever seen those pictures of people being given oranges. They all used to go to oranges stations and be dished out so they wouldn't get scurvy. They have vitamin C. So she was very taken with this, and she carried on with it throughout her adult life. So I just felt that it was for me, it was iconic, and I had to use it. She never said it.
She was an orange seller.
She might have said it, but I don't think she did.
And she took Charles II's fancy by selling oranges. It's true, and became his mistress.
Yeah.
And was painted by great painters.
She was.
Yeah.
So I thought that would be good. Yeah. But the Mrs. Beaton quote is real.
Yes. About the marmalade and the scum coming.
Yeah, because we
top.
Have Mrs. Beaton.
Yeah. So what did you have in mind with the Mrs. Beaton quote?
Oh, I just thought I'd chuck it in.
But you mustn't. There's people write essays about
it. I can't help it.
It's really naughty. And they say, we're primed to look for oranges by the initial two epigrams. Well, they are.
Really naughty. Oh, dear. Yeah. I'm sorry.
And there's a really intense orange bit. When the character goes into hospital.
Oh yes.
And there's for about there's like oranges.
There are, yes.
And that's and that isn't that
what
where?
What was I on?
And that's where the mother says oranges are the only fruit.
She does.
And then later, page 167.
This is really, it's really.
She says oranges are not the only fruit. You know, people build dissertations.
She was modernising, wasn't she? She was going forward. That was progress.
She discovers tin pineapple. She
does.
Doesn't eat it herself, but she gives it to. She gives it to the unfortunates.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, that was a terrible episode actually, because when I went to Oxford, I finally got myself in there with great trials and struggles. But anyway, I did. When I got there, my tutor is thankfully dead. I'm really
As
glad
an academic,
that,
this is always...
No, he's... I tell you, there's nobody who was taught by this man who isn't thankful he's dead. Anyway,
I know who you're talking about.
You're not surprised, are you? Anyway, he came up to us and he said to my friend, he said, "You're the black experiment." He said to me, "You're the working class experiment." So that was how it was going to be. And when I took, there was a point where I really did try and sort things out with my parents. And I thought, right, I'm at Oxford now. They don't want me to be here, but I'm going home and I'll take my friend Vicky with me and we'll see how it goes. We'll stay for two nights. Anyway, we went. Mrs. Winterson also at that point thought she might be on her best behaviour. It collapsed. But what she had done was gone out and she'd filled her war cupboard completely with tinned pineapples because I'd said Vicky was coming and that her parents came from St. Lucia and she'd gone into spasm and thought, what, you know, what do they eat? Well, she really had. And so it was everything. It was, she'd come up and she'd say, "Would you like a bit of tinned pineapple? I've made a pineapple upside down cake. Would you like gammon with pineapple?" And on it went, and poor Vicky was forced to just stuff herself with pineapples. And that's all she ate. And then, of course, after 2 days, it all went wrong because never mind, but it did. And I never went back.
You must. I can go on and on about fruit. You mustn't let me. You mustn't. Yes.
I was just going to ask you how you've been talking about oranges are not the only fruit for quite a while, I guess. And
strangely, I haven't. You know, I haven't talked about it for years. Yeah, that's why I don't. I'm struggling a bit.
And I'm thinking how you have this first book now that your latest has been published. Mm. And how does it feel a bit like being dragged back to somewhere, or is it always a new story? Is it a bottle you are forced to open every single time with the message in it? You know, because I'm sitting here listening to pineapples and then I think of bananas, insects in the cherry, pineapples and bananas and oranges. Yeah. And then thinking, how does it feel to be, you know, crack it open again and tell it again? Is this another story? You know, talking about your own story?
Oh, it's always another story. And it's not autobiography in any obvious sense. The things that happened are now so tied in with things that didn't happen that you can't really separate them. And it doesn't matter because it is about trying to find something which is real and which then can continue. I don't mind talking about it. I don't mind anything anymore. I've come to this place of complete zen. How can this have happened? You know, I used to doorstep journalists. I've given it all up. I have arrived at a completely different place. Strange. But no, I don't mind because I see them now. That's what they are. They're what I do, and they're all together. And I don't mind which of them I talk about if it's got any relevance to other people, such as yourself.
But the latest,
it's all one.
The latest one, I don't know if a question has read it, the adoption story
comes
back very directly.
It does come back,
in the latest
it does.
One. I thought quite effectively. That seemed to me to be, I know it's fiction, I know it's not autobiography, but it comes back pretty directly.
It does come back directly. I mean, I hit it again, obviously it hit in a different way in Sex in the Cherry, where the dog woman rescues Jordan from the Thames and takes him to live with her. And I mean, they're all lost and orphaned and dispossessed somewhere or another all the way through. And then it comes back in the power book with the Mockmole family, who go and get themselves a baby to take to the scrapyard with them. And then it came back here quite late in the day because I went after, unfortunately for Dad, after his second wife died, I went to clear stuff out and then I found these other bits of paper and I thought, blimey, here it is, but this won't go away. So I swung the book round, it's true, because this is a great thing about not writing sequentially. I had to put it in. And two things happened. Penguin lost my manuscript on the tube at Balham. How humiliating is that? And I found these papers.
No,
yeah, they really did.
Did.
They really did. I didn't make it up. And Balham, I mean, not Hampstead. I hope no one here tonight has come from Balham. But if you have, it's all right. But anyway, my tube was that was my tube line. So I thought, well, I'll put that in and see how it swings the book. I knew it would be a lever, but I thought, well, I'll try it. So I took it back because it was moving in a different way, and it's terribly late delivery this because of that. But I think you have to work right to the end, and I would have pulled it if I'd had to redo it completely. I wouldn't have published it at all. But there was a chance it was going that way.
Yes, sir.
They're not fixed, these things, you know. Mm-hmm. Not these creative writing bloody classes.
I thought the bit where she started hallucinating and seeing the orange devil at a time when she was accused, first accused, quite interesting. Can you talk about that a little bit? And does that have any significance, or where did that originate from?
Yeah, the orange demon, yes. And well, my church was big on demons. And people were regularly exorcised, and houses were as well. Mrs. Winston's explanations were much the same. I mean, I remember sitting at home once and seeing something shoot across the floor, which was normal because we did have quite a lot of mice around. And I said, "Oh, what was that?" in a rhetorical sort of way. And she didn't even look up. She said, "It must be ectoplasm," which is an unusual answer. And I was in it. I thought, "Oh yeah, it's ectoplasm. Everybody." Probably has that and just accepted it as part of my general vocabulary. But they did, and I did, and so whenever there was any aberrant behaviour, it was assumed that you were demon possessed, that something from the outside had entered you. Very normal, the Greeks thought so, didn't they? They thought
Daniel Defoe is completely full of it. If anything weird happens, Robinson Crusoe says, "Oh, it must be the devil that put that
gone in there,
just to scare me and freak me out." Yeah,
and we until the Enlightenment, and a lot of people beyond, we really thought that these things happened. And I think Jung has a very good point where he says it's all very well saying none of that stuff's out there, but then we just bring it all back inside, and it's still as vicious and as dangerous and as dark as it ever was, just because you say there's no devil living in that tree. The devil's come to live in you in a very different sort of a way. Looking at our own escapades in the 20th, 21st century, I'd hardly think we say we've been rid of our demons and our devils the way we've treated the planet and one another. But for them, it was indeed that this was something outside of you that could be rid of in a very straightforward way. And that's what happened. And of course, as far as they were concerned, for me, it didn't work. And yes, if you haven't had any food and you're locked up for 3 days, you are going to have some interesting sort of brain reactions. And I did. And it's not the first time it's happened. I suppose it won't be the last, but in extreme circumstances. But again, it's the thing that you use. You bring it back in and you find a way of talking about it.
You talked about the extreme circumstances, and this gets me back to something serious. When I reread your book, I was absolutely gobsmacked about the lack of bitterness. You've been talking about writing from a wound, and, for goodness sake, for most of us who haven't been through the experience that you went through, and she wasn't even your natural mother, you were adopted, there'd be so much bitterness and sorrow, but that doesn't come out in the novel. In fact, when I started reading it, I thought this phrase, "orange is not the only fruit," was going to be something you said when you suddenly started standing up to your mother and having a mind of your own. But no, you were kind enough in the novel to let her say it, to show that there was redemption in there, in the middle of all this dreadfulness. You were very, very kind to the character.
Well, the worst characters always get the best lines. Look at Richard II. I'm not bitter, no. I mean, there's a lot of... less now, but there was... I mean, huge anger, of course, and all sorts of other things that go along with that. And we talked about that were in enormous pain. The things that are actually about your life that you have to work through, and the people that love you and care for you, all of that, in the private sphere, is what you deal with. It's your lot, and you can't change it. All you can do is work with it. I think that's crucial. But bitter, no. I mean, maybe it's just a fortunate temperament. I've never felt bitter. Fucking furious. Yeah. But not bitter. And certainly as I've got older, I don't blame them. There's no point. Look, when you read the stories, there are, get rid of the Hollywood happy ending, which is rubbish, and there are only three other endings, aren't there? Three possible endings to any story: revenge, tragedy, and forgiveness. Those are the three endings. You have to choose.
I think you've... Oh, yes, no.
I came back then.
to choose, yeah. I was about to say, what a brilliant ending, but no, it's not.
Just to have an utterly trivial ending, perhaps, you dedicated the book to Jill Saunders and Fang the Cat. And my friend here is a very big cat fan. Do you remember Fang the Cat very fondly?
Oh, I love cats. I couldn't live a life without cats. And I've always had them, always strays. They always find me and I always take them in. I love them. I think you have to have, you know, in all the fairy stories, you find an animal helper, don't you? And I rely on that. Everybody needs a little familiar, and I always need a special cat who'll come to my studio with me to work. And I always get one. I've got a great one at the moment called Spikey, and I get up in the morning and I say, come on, Spikes, go to the studio.
Spike, that's
off
the character in the new...
I know, I named the robot after my cat. No, actually, I think I might name the cat after the robot. Anyway, it all goes round, doesn't it? It's family life. But that's why.
Are we going to release Jeanette to her glass of Chardonnay in the signing section? Yes, we are.
We are. Thank you very much.
Guardian Unlimited.